On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
There's a great amount of talk around America about the super rich. Who exactly are the super rich? You might be surprised to find out that the often quoted one percenters are not the super rich. They're just pretty rich. There are people much more rich than that. And here to talk about the level of that these people are living in, what's good about it, what's bad about the rest of the country about it, and what can we do about it, if anything, is Michael Mechanic. He's senior editor at Mother Jones Magazine, and his new website is readjackpot.com. That's because his new book is Jackpot, How the Super Rich Really Live and How Their Wealth Harms Us All. It's from Simon & Schuster. Michael, thank you very much for joining us today on the Bookshelf.
Well, thanks for having me, Doc.
There are some people that are not just pretty rich. They are people that are ridiculously rich, and most of us in America really have no idea just how rich can be. For me, rich would be if you had $1 million. And so, because then you wouldn't...
I'm laughing.
Because then you'd say, well, I could afford to buy a new car. I could afford to buy a little sailboat. But what we're talking about is exponentially more rich than that.
Wealth is a very much a comparative thing, a relative thing. In fact, my father's a professor, and at one point, Myanmar opened its doors to outsiders for the first time, and he managed to go there. He said the people there were so poor that, you know, the workers didn't even have wheelbarrows. They would carry these like giant loads on their backs. And he said people were so poor, but they didn't actually realize that they were poor because all their neighbors were so poor too. And when you have the house and the guy next to you builds a house twice as big, then you go, oh. And that's the way people compare themselves to the people around them and the people in their kind of tier. I think I quote in the book Bertrand Russell saying, beggars don't envy billionaires. They envy other beggars who are more successful. So I was laughing about $1 million because, you know, when I was a kid, you know, watching Gilligan's Island, it would be the millionaire was Thurston Howell III, and
right.
he was the leisure class, and he called his wife Lovey, and his previous life had been sitting by the pool drinking cocktails, counting his ducats. Well, you're not even in the top 10% of the wealthiest Americans if you have $1 million these days. The 10% consists of 18.3 million families, and just the threshold to get in is 1.1 million. So you're barely in at 1.1 million. The average household wealth in that tier is 5.3 million. Now, if you got $1 million, the chances are most of it is your house. You live in an area like the San Francisco Bay Area where I live. You know, two bedroom houses around here, it's hard to find them for under $1 million, which is it's insane.
Right.
But if you happen to come in and buy a house 10 years ago at a more reasonable price, you're a billionaire now. I mean, in fact, like there was a study came out in 2016 from the St. Louis Fed that if you were middle-aged and white or Asian, your chances of being a millionaire were 1 in 5, and it was 1 in 10 if you were black or Latino. But yeah, so $1 million these days, it's not as much as it used to be. you're no longer the leisure class. In fact, you by no means have you quit working, and you probably can't even fly first class. The 1%, it's 1/10 as many families, it's 1.83 million families. To get into the 1%, the minimum you need is 5.6 million, and the average household wealth is 26.7 million. So now you're starting to move into a higher tier. But remember, every time you go up, you pick off the 10% of every category, and the wealth just goes up exponentially. Let me give you an example. Think about the share of the national wealth that is owned by different groups. I asked somebody at a book event, because Americans, they're not quite in touch with how staggering the divide is, like how much wealth is skewed to the top. Even, you know, we think we are. We talk about this stuff all the time now. We actually started talking about it in 2011, the Occupy movement. That's sort of how the first 1% versus 99% parlance got into our culture. Before that, we weren't really talking much about it. But now we do. Now it's a big issue for many people. But this woman, I said, okay, just giving an example of how off people are. I said, what percentage of the national wealth would you say is owned by the top 10%, the wealthiest 10%? And she said, I don't know, you know, 40% maybe? And I said, no, it's 74% as of 2022. Okay, but now pick off the top 10% of that group. So now we're talking about the 1%. How much do they own? 37% of all the wealth. So they are taking more than half of the total owned by the top 10%. And it's the same as you go up. The top 0.1% owns 19% of the national wealth. So every time you cut off the top 10%, they own at least half of the wealth of that whole larger category. Now, on the other end is also, you know, people vastly overestimate the wealth at the lower end. And this was the subject of a kind of a famous experiment by these professors, Michael Norton and Dan Ariely, where they asked people, they said, well, what would be a fair distribution? And also, what do you think is the distribution in America? And people vastly overestimated the wealth of the lower tiers. They asked them, for like the bottom 40%, the least wealthy 40% of the population, they said, how much of the national wealth do you think they own? And they said, well, things being as unfair as they are, they probably own about 9%. The real sad reality was they owned 0.3%.
Wow.
Yeah, it's staggering. And now that was some years ago, and now they own nothing, no assets whatsoever. And you say, how could that possibly be? Well, that's because the people at the top of that tier own something, but the people in the bottom 20% are negative. They're on debt.
They're more in debt than their assets.
Exactly.
In the book Jackpot, you talk about what it's like to be in this upper echelon rich. And you talked to a lot of very interesting people, and some of them didn't particularly want to talk to you about it, which is an interesting thing, isn't it? In America, we can talk about all sorts of things openly, but one thing that hardly anyone ever will talk about is how much money they have or how much money they have coming in. If you're middle class or below, you don't talk about it because you think, well, somebody else is going to have more than me and I don't want to be embarrassed. When you're much richer, you hate to mention it because of a couple of factors that you mention in your book. One, then people are going to hit you up for money, and, and they're going to hit you up for favors, and every charity in the world is going to put you on their mailing list.
Yeah, and you're pigeonholed. Like, people, I talked to one woman, and she said, you get into the philanthropy world, and I feel like people just start seeing you as this rich mark. And all they don't look past the fact that you're wealthy. They don't look at you as a person. Yeah, so people don't want to be categorized that way and perceived as just this wealthy person, because, you know, there's a lot of antagonism toward the wealthy in this country, and a lot of it's deserved and some of it's less deserved.
Right.
But if you, you know, you happen to be a successful person, you're going to be judged and called greedy, and people will think you're a jerk just because you have that money. And that's not always the case. Many of the criticisms really are systemic criticisms. You know, the way people are allowed to grow the money the way they do and avoid taxes the way they do, that those are societal problems. But the very small minority of the super wealthy people are out there pushing those rules and, you know, pressing the envelope and trying to gain more advantage all the time. And then at the other end, you have ones out there in public saying, we're not paying enough taxes. This is unfair. We should reform the system. And then mostly you have the big in-between where people are just going about their business, not paying much attention to any of it.
Our mutual friend Chuck Collins wrote a book over a year ago, and we had a chance to talk about it. And he's one of the...
The patriotic millionaire.
The idea is, hey, we inherited a bunch of money. Yes, we worked hard, but we started out on third base. And that was the name of his book. You know, when the idea being so many benefits to having wealth in your family.
Chuck had an inheritance that he gave away when he was young.
Right.
Early 80s, he had it was basically given $500,000. He was one of the Oscar Mayer heirs. And he at the time was working with some people at a mobile home park who were kind of under the gun and being tooled around by their landlord. And he kind of helped them organize themselves. Seeing this firsthand, seeing the kind of things that people go through when they don't have this family cushion of wealth, kind of, it was a revelation for him. And he ended up giving all that money away, which, you know, in today's money, that would be worth, you know, $15 million or something,
right,
if you could put it in the stock market then.
And he did point out, and you point out in Jackpot, that even if you did that, you're not able to give away the benefits of growing up in a family where you never had to worry about making the house payment or anything. And as you point out in Jackpot, one of the benefits of being from a family that has that kind of money and that kind of deep wealth is that the odds of you going to a place like Harvard or Yale are exponentially better than if you're a guy whose, you know, dad was Ed Norton or something, working in the sewers in New York City, in the Honeymooners. And that's one of the things about wealth envy too, isn't it? The realization that it's not just having the money, it's because you grew up having money that the kind of issues that a lot of people in middle class or lower class socioeconomic classes routinely have to handle are never, ever, ever an issue for them.
Right. And I mean, these days it's all about college debt and people graduating and being immediately at a disadvantage. I mean, it can really set people back for a long time coping with these debts.
Right.
And so for some people, like the value of a college education, they're starting to be in doubt.
Right.
Because, you know, they see everybody in debt around them. You come from a family, and I'll be honest, like my dad, he's a sociologist, he wrote a textbook, and he dedicated the proceeds from that textbook to my college education, so I didn't have to pay for college. But I went to a public university. It was a lot cheaper when I went to school. Nowadays, it's incredibly expensive.
Yeah.
Graduating debt-free is a huge privilege these days. And so, and if you have that, you're immediately like a big step ahead of other people. And what's funny is, you know, there are things like college savings accounts that are tax advantage that the government put in place to help people save, which is, you know, that's all well and good, but you have to have the money to put in them in the first place. And
right.
None of that, as I write, I have a book, a chapter called Getting In, which is all about this. It's all about the advantages mm-hmm. in higher education enjoyed by wealthy families. These 529 plans, the rules are set up in a way that the benefits go more so to the wealthy families. And this in this example, I calculated the 1%er versus the middle class person. The wealthy person got 9 times the level of government subsidies from their 529 plan versus the middle class person. But it's the same with retirement savings. It's vastly skewed towards the upper classes.
In case you're just joining us, we're talking to Michael Mechanic, the author of Jackpot, How the Super Rich Really Live and How Their Wealth Harms Us All. It's from Simon & Schuster. And if you'd like to find out more about the book, the website is easy to remember, readjackpot.com. In America, one of the growth industries these days seems to be lotteries. We often think of lotteries as a poor man's tax. It's a disproportionate number of people who really can't afford to drop $5 or $10 a day buying lottery tickets that buy most of the lottery tickets. But in Jackpot, you say that is an inaccurate assessment of how lotteries work.
So if you ask people, have you bought a lottery ticket in the last year, the chances are that people with higher incomes are more likely to have bought a lottery ticket than people with lower incomes. If you're over $90,000 a year versus under $36,000, the richer people are more likely to have bought a lottery ticket. As far as the frequency, the really chronic players, they tend to be poor. But on the whole, like everyone's playing it, and it's not to do with your level of education or wealth necessarily. People just have this fantasy. I mean, I would say, you know, rich, really rich people don't tend to play. It's like upper middle class people might play because they're like,
right.
Hey, you know, everybody's looking up to the next level. I could be free, right? If I had just had all this money, I could be free and I could do whatever I wanted. I could quit my job that I hate. Not every upper middle class person likes their job either. But rich people don't like their jobs, but they do it to maintain the lifestyle that they have. In fact, I know a guy from college who made a fortune, and you know, I went to his house and he's like, look around. He's like, I don't like my work right now, but this lifestyle, if I want to maintain it, you know, this big trade-off.
You talk in the book about what usually happens, and we've all heard the horror stories of people who win a bazillion dollars in the lottery and then they end up miserable and broke and alone, wife leaves them, or they leave their wife, and they're miserable, and it just was a terrible thing for them. Is that because we just don't really know how to wisely use an influx of cash an influx of wealth like this, whereas the people who've always had money, they have systems, right?
Yeah, they do have systems. I mean, first I would say that, you know, the lottery story that we hear, you know, we tend to hear the horror stories more than the boring non-horror stories.
Right.
So we have that conception, and it's certainly true for, you know, a subset of winners. But what they all have in common is if it's public and they have a big jackpot, they are under siege, you know, by long-lost friends and relatives and scammers and wealth management people trying to, you know, to haul them in and collect fees for their services. And on the whole, you know, people win the lottery are not, you know, most of us are not super financially sophisticated. And so
right.
So by default, most lottery winners are not either, and they're probably less likely to be financially sophisticated than the person who makes $1 billion in an IPO. And so all of a sudden, everything in their life is suddenly up in the air, suddenly changes. And, you know, you go into work and you're this weirdo at work. Why are you still working here? You're rich, right? Your boss doesn't have any financial leverage over you. They probably don't want you there. You're a distraction. So people quit their jobs and then they're like, okay, well, now what do I do? Mm. We kind of sit around. We think we have this dream of like, what would I do if everything was possible? But when that actually happens, it's like, well, what do I do? Yeah. And I talked to some people who came into a fair amount of wealth and quit their career, in some cases not a low-end career. And then it was sort of like, well, so now I'm going to sit on the boards of nonprofits and be part of this sort of wealthy crowd. And when people ask me what I do for a living, it gets uncomfortable because I've got to kind of admit to them, I don't really do much of anything. I just participate in these, you know, on boards, etc. There's definitely some self-esteem issues wrapped up in all that. Because, we put so much of our life into our work and so much meaning into our work.
Right.
I mean, not all. There are other ways to find meaning, but we live in a society that very much values the idea of work, even though, and I'll say, even though we don't favor, our tax code does not favor workers over people with a big pot of money sitting around. I mean, that's one of the big things that I really never understood about our tax code, the way we reward capital profits by giving them a much lower tax rate than the profits we make from working every day. It's like we are a nation that has always revered hard work. We talk about it all the time. You know, that's what gets you ahead. That's what makes you whole. Doing your best at whatever the task is, but then our tax code says, okay, we're going to reward the guys who already have a big pot of money and just put it in the right stock and now and made a fortune, and they're paying less on that, that profit than you and I do on our paycheck.
Right. I was trying to remember the exact quote, but there was a Senator Dirksen back in the 1960s who was making a point about government spending and basically said something to the equivalent of $1 billion here, $1 billion there. Before long, you're talking about real money. and I always loved that because that just keeps it, except now it'd be $1 trillion here. The chapter on Capitol Hill is very disconcerting, honestly, of all the chapters in the book, that many of which are kind of eye-opening and a little horrifying. But I think the fact that what we've always figured, those of us who don't have our own lobbyist, have always figured, apparently is true, that one of the ways to really know that you are really connected, that you could call a legislator and they would take your call and they would listen to what you have to say, is to have a big, big pile of money. I think in here you said there's something like 11 lobbyists for every Congress member, and some of these are ex-Congress members, they get hired to curry favor, and they all come with cash. One of the biggest things that I learned years and years ago about politics is everybody wants to get reelected. And to get reelected, you have to get money. And most people don't particularly like hitting up folks for money, but they have to because that just is part of the deal. So if you have an extraordinary amount of money, that gives you more leverage, say, than you or me or people that don't make as much money as we do, who just like to think that if we wrote a letter to the congressman or congresswoman that they would write back to us, it's not going to get even happened.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just the donations to individuals, but now the way the campaign finance has been gutted, it allows you to give almost an unlimited amount to parties. And so when, if I'm a wealthy guy and I give, $500,000 to the Republican Party, you could bet that the leadership of the party is going to put pressure on their people to do what I want to do. It really is undue clout. And it's not even just politicians. It's like, as is one of my sources, Nick Hanauer, who's worth probably close to $1 billion. He said, it's this undeserving access to people, university presidents, big philanthropists, whatever, other super prominent people, celebrities, politicians, your senator is going to call you back. And I mean, that is pretty, pretty key, because the research shows that the very wealthy in this country have different ideas about what's good for the country. So the policies end up reflecting the views of the wealthy and not the views of everyone else. And not only that, wealthy people have an expectation that politicians will pay attention to them. And so they reach out much more. There was some research done in which they found that it's something like in the past 6 months, half of the very wealthy people in this study had reached out to their politician, their congressman or senator, and in many cases have also reached out to high-ranking regulators and things like that in government over very specific issues, banking regulation or policy issues, not just, hey, I like you, I'm going to give you some money or whatever.
Right.
And then there was another public survey of the same thing, except they said, how many of you have reached out to your member of Congress in the past 5 years? And the percentage is there way, way lower. It's just a very small number had. And again, it's they're reaching out in ways that they're never going to have any impact. They're sending an email, part of a form email, or even writing a letter or calling the person's office. But still, you're just a check mark. Whereas if you are a big donor, you have access. You have access directly. You go to fundraisers. You show up. Super wealthy crowd, as much as many of them would like to say otherwise, they are reluctant to support legislation that would make things more equal. And in fact, I just recently wrote a piece for Mother Jones about this. There was some new research that came out. It essentially shows that anybody who's in an advantaged group is on average going to be resistant to a disadvantaged group getting more, even if it means more for the advantaged group too. I mean, it is so arbitrary that in one experiment, the researchers told people you're going to be assigned based on a personality test to one of two groups, the Eagles or the Rattlers. And in fact, they assigned everyone to the Rattlers. Mm. They told them the Rattlers were, the Rattlers had this much and the Eagles had this much and the Eagles had much less. And they said, then they gave them the potential policies that would change the distribution. And then they gave them the policy where the Eagles would get a lot more and the Rattlers would get some more. So everybody would, it was sort of a win-win situation, but the Rattlers did not like that at all because the Eagles got more.
Yeah.
it became more equal. They didn't want to be more equal.
What can we do? It seems to me like the only people that really have the kind of clout to change things are the ones that very often say, why should we change things? We like it the way they are. This is the tough thing, isn't it? We know things need to change, keep our society healthy. There are small numbers of people that are doing something about it. What's it going to take?
Well, we got to convince the Rattlers, right? The Rattlers have to say, hey, this is ridiculous. It's getting ridiculous. Or, there have to be appeals to them, appeals in their own self-interest. I mean, for instance, Nick Hanauer, the guy I was just talking about, this vast sum of money, and yet he's decided to dedicate his personal activism to making things more equal. He's sort of an anti-inequality guy, pushing for $15 minimum wage and that sort of thing. And he makes a capitalistic argument. He says, look, most successful people are selling products and services to the masses. If you don't let people make enough money, you don't pay your workers enough so that they can afford those things, you're cutting into your own bottom line. So he's making a plutocratic appeal.
Yes.
He said.
Yes.
And this is a guy who has a private jet and two yachts and five houses. So he's going around calling himself a plutocrat, proudly calling himself a plutocrat, and yet arguing for more fairness in our tax system.
And
he's
an
interesting cat.
I think that's what it's going to take. I mean, as I was finishing your book yesterday, I thought in the later 1960s and the early 1970s, after the civil rights movement had achieved the goal of opening people's eyes, particularly non-African Americans, to what was going on and how inequitable the political system had become and everything else, and had been preloaded all along that we needed to change things, it basically was not so much convincing black people that things were bad. They already knew. The main thing was convincing white people that it was in the interest of the country to change the attitudes, treat people genuinely as equals. And of course, that's still a work in progress, obviously. But there had to be a big movement in the early 1970s, say, among even the local governmental officials, that if this thing is going to be right, if we've ever got a chance of being right, if we're ever going to be able to do what Reconstruction was trying to do, and before it got all twisted back and turned back over on itself, to actually have fair and equitable voting rights and so forth, that it's going to have to be from the people that have the power, and they're going to have to voluntarily give up the power that they have enjoyed just by virtue of being not black. And people had to realize, if we're going to make things better, then the people who have the power are going to be the ones that step up. It kind of seemed to me the same way. The people who are in the catbird seat, so to speak, who are the ultra wealthy, if they can become convinced that it's in their best interest for the whole country to do better, then we might be able to do something about it.
Yeah, you know, we saw in 2020, people started opening their wallets to racial equity giving, and they gave more money in 2020 than they had the whole previous decade for those causes.
Right.
Now, my question is, will that continue? Because what we've seen is a backlash. I mean, just like Reconstruction was violently overthrown by essentially domestic terrorism, if you look back into that history. I mean, it's just crazy and abhorrent, and the North just decided they didn't want to deal with it, so they threw up their hands and let things slide back, leading to, you know, a long period of problems. You know, we've seen a backlash to the racial justice movement and the George Floyd thing. We've seen a backlash, the things that the Biden administration was trying to come in to do. And, you know, things are pretty ugly right now. I'm less optimistic than I was when I finished the book. I still am knocking wood and like hope that people will come to their senses, because there are a lot of smart people and people with wealth and power who are taking the other side now, but things are so fraught, I'm just not quite sure where this is all going to go. And it has to be more widespread. And, you know, I wish I had a magic bullet, but.
Well, just the idea that people are talking and are at least armed with this information is a big step in the right direction. And the fact that the people who are uber wealthy no longer can really operate so much in the secret corridors as they have up to this point, that people who are middle class can read your book and go, really? This is the system? We thought it was that the example you use in here about monopoly, which I wish we had time to get into, just a huge eye-opener. So I think the fact that information is getting in the hands of more and more people has got to be a step in the right direction. And I appreciate the fact that you took time to talk to us on the radio about this and on my podcast. I want to say, is there anything else that you wish that I'd asked that I didn't, and that you have a chance to get right before we go?
Well, I would like to point out to your listeners that even though we're talking about some very heavy subjects, I tried to write a book that is not—it's not a tirade, right?
It's
a book that explores a lot of things, but it's actually can be quite entertaining, as well as eye-opening.
Indeed.
And Doc, did you find that to be the case?
Yes, indeed. And of course, I also know that you sent me a hardback copy, but the paperback just came out a month ago, so people can afford to get a copy of the book and read and learn and kind of have your eyes open about serious stuff, but not it's not like reading an economics textbook. Too, with all due respect to my friends who are economists or economics professors, it's a lot more entertaining and interesting than that.
Yeah, well, I hope people do pick it up, because this is, you know, so many things are linked to the increasing wealth inequality. So many of our other problems are tied into it. And if you don't understand this, you're not going to understand really where we're at in America right now.
Michael Mechanic, our guest today, his new book, Jackpot, How the Super Rich Really Live and How Their Wealth Harms Us All. It's from Simon & Schuster, and like I said, it's now available in paperback. For more, check the website readjackpot.com. Michael, thank you so much for making time to be with us today.
It's been my great pleasure.
Thanks so much for joining us on The Bookshelf. We'll see you next time right here on your favorite radio station and your favorite podcast on thebookshelf.podbeam.com. Until then, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby, reminding you that the love of money is the root of all evil. That's what the Bible says, and it's still true. Thanks for listening, and God bless.